Hi, Halton here. For our friends at Unimac, easily train and protect your crew to NFPA 1851 standards with effective washer extractors that sanitize your PPE, simple record keeping, and proper training on how to be NFPA 1851 compliant. Unimac is called upon by fire crews everywhere to meet these needs. Get the details at unimac.com/sanitize.
Welcome to Politics and Tactics. Cut a little short there, so sorry for the delay. Let's go to area code 732. We have a caller. Who am I on with?
That's Dave McGlynn.
Dave McGlynn. Dave, how you doing? Welcome to Politics and Tactics. You're on with Sam Vellani and Dave Polykoff, both who are working in Montgomery County, Maryland tonight. So we appreciate you calling in. Before we get to Dave, I just want to go over one quick thing. We've been talking a lot about forever chemicals lately and the fact that these PFABs get into your bloodstream, and we know now that our gear has them loaded in them and it's shedding off. Right now, NFPA is considering an amendment, and the amendment would give the choice for the chemical companies and the manufacturing companies to make gear without forever chemicals in them. So how great is that? So the public comment section, the public, your ability to comment publicly is open until August 4th. Our Google Hangout on the fourth Wednesday of the month, we're going to cover it in depth. I'll also be tweeting it out. But if you think your gear should, and you should have the choice to wear gear that's free of forever chemicals, which I think we all agree that nobody wants that cancer-causing chemicals in their gear, please support the amendment of NFPA. And what it does is there's a standard now that talks about UV light degradation, and it basically allows the gear manufacturers not to do that test or to amend the test. So stay tuned for more information on that. Dave, welcome to the show. Are you going to be teaching at FDIC? And if so, if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your background.
Yeah, thanks. So I'm going to be at FDIC again this year. Pretty excited that we're finally doing it. With COVID and all the date changes, it was seeming like it was not going to happen. I'm so glad it is. I'm glad to see you out there. I'm glad to see a bunch of the people, reconnect with a bunch of the people. So for any of your listeners that don't know who I am, my name is Dave McGlynn. I am from New Jersey. I recently transferred from West Point, the U.S. Military Academy, to Pennsylvania at the Letterkenny Army Depot, where I'm an assistant chief. Still running a training program, so I'm excited about that. I've been in the fire service for 20 years, right for fire engineering, teach at FDIC, all that good stuff. So my class is called So You Want to Be a Training Officer, Do You Have What It Takes? And literally, if the title doesn't describe what the class is about, then I don't know how else to describe it. But I'll be there Wednesday, August 4th. At 1:30 in room 234, so hopefully it doesn't conflict with people that already have obligations. I know that I'm competing with a great card of a cadre of people at the same time slot, so if anybody comes, I appreciate it.
Dave, wait a second. So you're not at West Point anymore? You're assistant chief in Pennsylvania? How am I going to get my sword?
Yeah. Don't worry, I still got connections over there. I didn't forget about you. As you texted me that one time. You said, don't forget my sword. I didn't have the heart to tell you. I'm like, yeah, I left. I don't want to tell him, no.
Dave Polykoff, you got a question for Dave?
Yeah, I think that I've been following you on the on the social media, and I saw that you were at Letterkenny, and I kind of got a little excited. I thought, wow, he went to Canada into Letterkenny, and I'm like, I got to get a T-shirt. And then I found out it's Pennsylvania. But
everybody for those keeps that saying don't know, that because of that Hulu show.
There's a little show on Hulu for Letterkenny. For those that don't watch it, I would recommend to see it. But either way, I'd like to get a T-shirt that says Letterkenny Fire Department. That would be pretty cool.
I'll hook you up, Dave. Don't worry.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, Dave, don't hold your breath. He's been saying that about a sword for a long time.
It's a little harder to come across a sword, right?
Sam Bellani, do you got a question for Dave?
No, I think I lost you. I lost you guys for like 30 or so seconds. I'm back on now. Communications-wise, of course, on my end.
No problem.
But,
we got
I know he's presenting at FDIC. What's the Dave? What's the title of your class?
Yeah, thanks. Again? It's So You Want to Be a Training Officer? Do You Have What It Takes?
Ah, yeah, that's a big one. That's I did 2 years at our training academy, and I don't think the training chief ever wasn't busy. You think about the gamut of programs that they're responsible for. That'll be a good class. That's definitely a hot topic, right?
Yeah.
Sam,
I appreciate that. Go ahead, Frank. Sorry, man.
Before you get started, Sam, tell Dave about your wheel of excuses. He'll appreciate that.
When I was in charge of our recruits, we had one of those wheels. We actually bought it on Amazon. You know, you can divide it up and put different things in there. So we had a wheel of excuses with all the excuses that a recruit could come up with for anything. And if they came in, they had this, and we spun the wheel to figure out what it was going to be.
That's genius. I got to get my hands on that.
The wheel of excuses.
Sam, do you have
a
picture
of it? Somewhere. I have a picture somewhere. I have to look. Okay.
The funny thing about the wheel is
that I guarantee that a lot of the excuses on there are similar to ones we've all heard already, too. That's the saddest part.
That's the beauty of the fire service.
That was the funny thing. I walk into the office, and every excuse in there I heard as a training officer. So I was like, this is hilarious. You should write an article just about that alone. So Dave, is this for existing training officers or people who want to be training officers? Give us a little insight into this.
That's a good question. So it's a new program for me, but it's not new for me. Frank, as you know, because you had helped me out a couple of times before, spinning some ideas off of you. I was doing a different program about networking out there. So this one is for aspiring training officers and for current training officers. But most importantly, it's for aspiring training officers because I feel like my goal right now in the fire service is to unbastardize the training officer's role. And I don't mean to pick on people specifically or individually. You gentlemen have been doing this longer than me, so you know. The issue that we've run into is sometimes people take that role because they can't hack it, on the rig anymore. They have such a huge ego that they just want to be in charge, so they got that opportunity to put on rank. Some people use it as like a segue to try to make it to being a fire chief, and those things are never good. The programs often fail. We got a lot of people that fake it till they make it. A lot of people who are very ingenuine, a lot of book smart people, which is great, but they don't know how to couple that with the experience level, the street smart aspect of it. So the class is really not to teach you as much as it's an eye opener. It's more of like a gut check. These are the things that should encompass a good training officer, and if you don't feel you have those things, I will give them to you, and hopefully you can take them back to your station or find a different trade, because being a training officer is not it.
Dave, and I'll go around the horn to Sam and Dave Polycroft for this, but one of the issues that I see with training officers, especially in mid-sized departments, city departments, and smaller departments, is that you get in that training role, and instead of it being about contact hours of actually delivering training or ensuring that there's at least, you know, two training periods going on each day, it seems that the fire chief's office often uses the training division as another administrative chief, and they get sucked in to doing everything but training, ordering equipment and evaluating equipment, PPE and everything else. And what really suffers is those contact hours. I'll go to Dave Polycroft first. Have you seen that in other departments? Montgomery County is pretty well squared away, and it's a large place. But have you seen that in your volunteer departments that you that you're a member of?
Yeah, when, you know, in my county, we are pretty squared away when it comes to the training. There is a lot that's asked of the training officer to develop programs, to our battalion chief in charge of training pretty much heads up the command competency stuff for all the command officers, but he's also overall responsible for all the other things that are happening there. Now, in the volunteer realm, you kind of have to be able to put on many hats, and your training will have to come from, well, if you've got an engine truck and a rescue squad in the station, well, you're going to have to be able to be versatile enough to train in all of those aspects of what your department delivers. On top of that, you're going to be funneled into other committees, like to spec out new apparatus, spec out maybe new tools and things like that. So you have to wear many hats when you're in a smaller department. But I think Sam was in that position as a captain, as a recruit training officer, and he can probably speak a lot better of what was expected of him. And it just went beyond the training of the recruits. So I'm going to kind of defer back over to Sam.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, traditionally your training academies focus on, you know, the recruit training and continuing education and that kind of stuff. But, you know, this whole command officer training is, you know, for the fire service is certainly relatively new. And I think we do a really fine job at it. I've participated as a dispatcher and as a basically extra hands in that office since its inception. Started as a radio operator for the scenarios and that kind of stuff. But so every department, you know, that whatever training academy they use, whether they have their own or they have a regional one, a training academy is really soup to nuts for everything we do. We're an all hazards agency these days, so you've got everything from urban search and rescue training to hazmat training, all your fire and EMS training, and add on to it the command officer development stuff, and training academies these days are busy spots, and they certainly, you know, they require leadership that are dynamic and dedicated, and I think we're lucky to have that for sure.
Dave, what's been your experience with that, with them lumping on to the training officer everything but training? Dave McLean.
yeah. So it's funny you say that. It's a double-edged sword. So I'll first say the positive of it. So for me, speaking just for myself, having been in the training officer world for a little over 5 years now, I would say I've been blessed in the opportunities of being able to understand the administrative side of things. I've acted as an ops chief. I've acted in the realm of fire chief duties. So typically in my experience, the training officer doesn't just do training, though that is the most important thing. And that's one of the things I'll touch on in the class. It's stuff that you gentlemen were just talking about. You know, you do essentially become a man of many hats. The crappy thing is that it's up to you to understand how to find the balance and how to discipline and organize yourself to find that balance and prioritize what's important without losing that touch, because at the end of the day, the training officer is the guy that has the most interaction with the guys. You know, your captains have their crew, your battalion chiefs have their crew, you know, your assistant chiefs have their, station or whatever it is, you know, however your department is structured, the fire chief is the fire chief of the whole organization. But the training officer quite literally makes or breaks everybody, you know, whether you have one or multiple ones. You know, that role itself, you're in the business of developing people. And like you were saying before, Sam and Dave, you were saying, you know, about this officer development stuff. It's new, and that's unfortunate, but so is everything in our business. You know, we start pulling back onion layers, and we start finding more and more stuff that we should be doing. That, again, is the training officer's role. So, you know, that's where I challenge the people that want to take on this responsibility of being a training officer. How can you essentially develop upcoming officers if you've never been a real officer? You know, like it's kind of a, you know, you're against the curve a little bit there, or you're against the grain, you know, and it's not to say, because I've seen some people that, you know, have really made a great career of themselves and maybe weren't the best fireman in the world. That's not my thing. I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, you need to have fought 1,000 fires in order to be a good training officer. That's not a prereq. That's not a realistic prereq, but you do have to have some kind of background and not just attend a fire officer class or an ICS class if you're going to try to develop, you know, the future of your organization. And what people fail to realize, both that run the organization, that are part of the organization, and then the training officers themselves, is how important that role really is. You know, a lot of responsibility goes through that office, and that's, you know, a lot of people don't realize that.
Without a doubt. And people also have to realize is that even the training officers that are super squared away, it doesn't mean that they're super squared away with everything. And one of the keys to being a successful training officer is to know what you're squared away with and what you need help with. There's just some classes some people shouldn't teach. I'll give you a perfect example. I think I'm a pretty good instructor, but you never want to take a pump operator class from me. It's not in my wheelhouse. It's something that, you know, I used to tell everybody there's only three numbers you need to know in the fire service: 150, 375, and 68. 150 is what you pump everything at. 375 is what you cook chicken at. 68 is the temperature of the firehouse. That's about my pump operating skills right there. So,
that's great.
So
I'm using
you
that.
Don't want Frank Ritchie teaching a pump operator's class. So just because somebody's a training officer, chiefs need to realize that doesn't mean they're good at everything. And as long as the training officer can recognize, hey, these are my strengths, or this is what I need somebody to cover my blind spot on, then you can be really successful. So one thing that, like, Montgomery County, Maryland, I believe, still does is they rotate people in and out of the training school. Is that correct, Sam?
Yeah, there's no hard and fast rotation time, but I think, you know, our department, not unlike a lot of other departments in the nation right now, are pretty young, and we've got a lot of people moving up through the ranks, so there certainly has been opportunity. I'd say, you know, the training chief before the last one was there for a very long time, and he did a lot of just incredible stuff. Got a lot of resources for us. He knew how to find the resources. So he got us a lot of stuff. Got us into our new training academy. You know, he was really something else. And then the chief that was there when I was there, he's moved to another division, but he did, you know, he helmed the brand new training academy. He was there. He was the there for the transition. Now we have another chief in there. He's doing also great things. So, you know, it's definitely been more dynamic. I mean, you know, think about your traditional fire service. You know, you'd have academy directors, academy chiefs, that kind of stuff there for years and years and years. It just so happened the last one we had that was there for a long time, Chief Clements, he was phenomenal. Just and he did all kinds of wild stuff back in the day. He was like he developed training crops. The FDNY got their first rabbit tool from Mike Clements, so that should tell you something.
That's the first rabbit tool you said?
Yes. And that was confirmed on one of those Getting Salty podcasts. Chief Hayde was talking about it.
That's funny. Dave Polycoff, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, so one of the things I want to go back to what Dave was talking about, and you know, you need to be able to do the job. You just can't, like he said, take a couple of classes and you become a training officer. There's an old saying out there that I personally take offense to when it comes to training, and that old saying of those who can't teach. I take offense to that because in order to be a good fire service instructor, you have to know what you're talking about. You have to have walked a mile in the shoes of a firefighter in order to teach those particular classes. So I would want a fire instructor that has gone down the dark hallway, has pulled a line, has, you know, made a grab, thrown ladders, all that stuff. So I want a confident and competent training officer who is capable of doing all the skills that they are teaching and expecting the students to be able to do as well. So I take offense to the old, you know, those who can't teach. I think it should be the other round. Those who are good at what they do make good instructors.
I can't agree more, and I think that's where the mentoring comes in. Dave, McGlynn, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, mentoring is a huge thing. You know, it's it goes hand in hand in everything we do, right? So in the fire service, we constantly talk about mentorship. But the training officer, again, just because we're talking about training officer, it's relevant in all realms of the fire service, especially the company officer. But that training officer role, you are a mentor. By definition, because the mentor is the person who's there for the long haul and develops for the future. That's literally the definition of the training officer. And to piggyback off of what Dave Polycoff was saying, you know, amen, brother, I'm with you there. I hate that, you know, those who can't do teach, you know. I've never been a great fireman. I know that. But I've done it long enough and seen a number of different things enough that I feel comfortable in the things that I'll head up. However, what I do know is I know how to network, and I know how to be humble enough to not sit there and, you know, think that I'm supposed to be in front of the classroom at all times. If I got a guy who's really squared away with technical rescue, he's going to help me put together that program, and I'll facilitate, but he's going to teach it because he's got that great knowledge. And that's another thing that, you know, the mentoring thing, it's like a reciprocating process, you know. We're doing that along the way with everybody. You know, you're tapping into each individual resource and subject matter expert throughout your organization so that you can really give everybody the goods, you know what I mean?
Without a doubt. Dave, now what's your role? I know you're chief of training. What's your role when you go to a fire? Are you the safety officer or – Are you a division officer? Where do you fall in the incident command system?
So the Department of Defense or the Army is a little different than most places. You know, I had done municipal work before I'd gotten into the federal side. So I have a set crew night where I'm the shift supervisor, and at that night I'm the ops chief. So, you know, here, and you guys down in Montgomery County, you'll get a chuckle out of this, but here in South Central Pennsylvania, they refer to the command vehicle as the boogie. So I'm in the buggy. you know, on my 24, my overnight, I'll be in the buggy, and I'll be the command officer and the shift supervisor, whatever it is. Outside of that, if something came in during my day shifts where I'm working just Monday through Friday day work, I'm doing administrative duty. But if there's an emergency, I can either act as an ops chief. I can be a division commander. I can be assigned to the Charlie side, whatever it is, you know, I could be the safety officer. I would just be another chief officer that you would be able to assign to look over a certain task.
Well, that's kind of great that you get to be ops as well as training. So that's kind of a nice cadre. Dave, Tony, the guys, fill a safety role or?
I think Dave has to turn his radio down in order so we can talk. So say what you said again, Frank.
Okay. In Montgomery County, the individuals assigned the training, do they respond to fires in a safety role, or what's their role? What's training do at a fire?
Normally our safety officer or our training folks are assigned to the training academy, and that's pretty much where they spend their day. We have assigned safety officers. That's actually a safety position or a safety captain that's assigned as on-duty position. So the guys and the gals that work at the training academy pretty much stay at the training academy, and they're responsible for delivering whatever content that is going on that day, whether it be developing new content, driver's training, recruit training, EMT training, EMTP training, stuff like that. So they're pretty much kind of locked into being at the training academy. Now, our battalion chief that's in charge of training, you know, he works a four-day work week as day work, but he can come out in the field on his day off working overtime or a night shift working as a battalion chief in the operations. But for the most part, the training academy folks, they stay where they are. And actually, Frank, I got to go. I got a call coming in, and I think so does Sam.
All right. Be safe.
Will do.
And be safe, guys.
Oh, yeah, I do. Yep.
Well, I hope you know where you're going. Dave, so it's you and I. So that's pretty cool because a lot of places, the training officer becomes either a safety officer or reports to the command post and becomes either a division chief or a division officer. So you're actually doing training and then filling the role as a battalion chief. The way –
Yeah.
You know, it's
– Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I just saying, you know, it's unique in the DOD in that aspect. You know, the administrative side of it is the training part, and every day I'm there, I'm with the crews, whether I'm the lead instructor or not. I like to try to be with them. It's a smaller department I belong to now than what West Point was, so I have more of an opportunity to be with them a lot more. But yeah, it is nice. That's what I was saying earlier is, you know, I've been blessed. A lot of people would consider it being taken advantage of or being bastardized, but I feel like that's a lot of on-the-job training that you can't buy. So I've been fortunate that while I was in West Point, because I had such a odd schedule there, I had filled in as an ops chief quite a bit, even though I was like a battalion chief running the training division. That it developed me now to my role now as an assistant chief. That's why the title is assistant chief, is because you basically are an all hands guy. Like your main focus that you manage and that you're responsible for is the training division, but you're still an operations chief. You still act as the fire chief. You know, you still make decisions. The operations chief and I have been doing the whole recruitment and hiring process right now because we had three positions that we're filling. So, you know, it's a nice feeling. It's unique compared to most training officers.
No, I think that's great. And one of the things, you know, it's one thing like in Montgomery County, Maryland, like Dave Polycroft was talking about, if you rotate in and say you're doing as an instructor for the recruit class and you're just staying at the recruit school, I mean, that's kind of sad because you're missing work, but you wouldn't want to put your training officer so that they don't respond to any fires or emergencies, because I think then they're lacking credibility in their craft. So, and there are some departments that do that where you go to the training academy and they're like, okay, you're at the training academy and that's the only place you go. I think that hurts your credibility. And I think that the people on the line, you know, after 6 months to a year, they're like, what's this person know? They're not on the line anymore. So for credibility and being viewed as competent, I think it's critical that you're able to go to fires and then not only to be able to participate in fires, but also to see how the training is, you know, how the training is actually impacting the fire ground. And are there issues that you need to develop training for? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, that's the thing is, in my experience, I've been fortunate, and that's going to be the one difficult part in my audience that I speak to when I'm out there is, you know, I do know because like I had said before, I had done 7.5 years on a municipal side. So I do know, you know, about the training academies and you know, that's where people will go for certain promotions, or sometimes they get stuck there because they did something wrong. you know, with me, it is nice because I'm able to see it unfold in front of me. So there's, you know, it's a twofold thing. Is one, I can see what we need to work on. So, like, as the call is going on, I'm already like, okay, I'm going to put that on the schedule next month. You know, like, or I'll see them do something that we practiced a few months ago, and I'm like, oh, wow. Like, you know, you get to kind of see the fruit of your labor unfold right in front of you, you know. So it is nice driving the seat that I drive, is that I have kind of a front row seat to really see how it all unfolds, where the gaps are, what we need improvement on, and then what we're doing right, you know. Not a lot of guys have that luxury, whether because the makeup or the way it's structured, or because of the size, you know, because of the size of the department. However, I agree with you 100%. Regardless of the size of the department, even in the FDNY, you know, and they do it right. You know, they'll send a guy there for only like 6 months. They'll just do like one academy class, and then they put them back in a company. You know, those guys can't just stay there to die. They need to be answering these calls in some capacity, because in order to train them, you're training them for the operations. So if you're away from operations, if you're segregated from operations, then what do you really know they're supposed to be training on?
You're 100% right. Now, where you're working in Pennsylvania now, do you go off the base on, like, normal mutual aid, or is it something where they have to actually special call you to go off the base? Do you have a district outside of the base?
Yeah, we have a really good mutual aid agreement. I would like to try to improve on that. That's through, you know me, you know, as far as, like, the networking thing goes, I have a way of trying to improve on that more, so we can get on more box assignments. But we're on a lot of automatic aid. So because we are a fully staffed career department, and the firehouse actually doesn't sit inside the gate, it's actually outside in town, you know. So we're able to see a lot more and do a lot more than the average, DOD department. We're utilized as a municipal department while we're serving the Army. So a lot of the mission is the Army, and where we work is very unique and has a lot of unique things to it. But we also, call volume-wise and experience-wise, we have, you know, a lot of it's a big thing. You know, the base is industrial, but then there's rural areas that we respond to automatic, and then there's city areas that we respond to automatic. So even though it's a two-company department, you're training them to to understand four true disciplines. So it's nice, but it also can be cumbersome. So what I've tried to do since I've been here is kind of do like this seasonal approach. Like, you know, our heightened call volume for rural calls are coming up, so we're going to practice that now, because this way we're kind of ready then, you know, and so on and so forth.
No, that makes sense. You said four disciplines. What are the four disciplines?
Well, so we certainly have a hazardous materials slash. I kind of put them together as a special ops thing. So we have a very large risk hazard for hazardous materials and explosives, weapons of mass destruction, and technical rescue. You know, in the industrial setting, and then. Then we have the city aspect of it, where our assignment is typically to go to the seaside, the Charlie side, or the rear, whatever you want to call it, you know, the back of the building. And then we have our brush mission, you know, where we do a lot of rural areas. We have a UTV and a brush truck, and we do a lot of automatic aid for that. Plus, in our first due area for, you know, the Army, we have a lot of rural area. And then we also have an ambulance service. So these are four disciplines that I have to make sure that everybody is pretty squared away with. Even if we only ran two calls in one of them, we need to be 100% when those two calls come in.
Without a doubt. Now, Dave, a question that some people might ask, so I'll ask it, is do you have to be in the Army to be a DOD firefighter? And if not, how do you become a DOD firefighter?
Now, great question. I'm glad you asked that. I constantly, you know, you and I did the Live from FDIC a couple of years ago with Steve Hamilton. We were trying to recruit people. You know, no. So the answer is no. So I'm a huge advocate and respecter of you know the prior servicemen. You know, I was raised in a military family. So the answer is no. You don't have to have served, and you don't have to be currently serving. You know, it's a civilian job, just like your regular city departments. You just happen to work for the federal government. In 01, pre 9/11, I had signed up for the Air Force. And they denied me for being colorblind. Well, fast forward past, you know, post 9/11, they needed people, so they lifted the restriction. Well, at this point, you know, I had already gotten in to the federal government, so I didn't need to have to worry about it anymore. I'd already gotten my job. But yeah, you know, I haven't served. I'm not a vet, and I made it to assistant chief working for the Department of Army. You know, so in order to do it, my suggestion to anybody is, one, have experience. Whether you work in a municipal department or you volunteer in your local community, I would absolutely recommend that. I would take as many classes as you can. We're in a world now where everything has become a national standard. So I would, any class you take, I would typically try to make sure that it has that Pro Board or ISTAC seal at the end of it, because that helps you, because we prioritize on national accredited certification. And then from there, usajobs.gov. So that's literally at usajobs.gov. Create yourself a profile. Create yourself a really good resume that is specific to the true details and duties of a firefighter, and then apply for a job. That's how I got in. I was fortunate. I had somebody help me with my resume years back, and I got in, and you know, it's been a great ride ever since.
And now you're the assistant chief. Do you see yourself becoming chief of department at some point, either where you're at now or somewhere else in the DOD?
So, I laugh because sometimes people are true to that, you know, and then some people are just trying to be modest. So I'll be honest, I never saw myself getting to where I'm at now. I thought, you know, man, if I could pass my EMT and retire as a firefighter EMT, I'll be happy, you know. And then when I got that done, I thought, well, if I could make captain, I'll be happy, you know. So to tell you the truth, I do want to be in that position one day, truly not for selfish reasons, but because as we grow in these positions, I call them positions of influence. So whether you're a company officer, a chief officer, a training officer, or the fire chief, your main thing isn't authority. It's not rank, but it's influence. And I've noticed that I've had a larger reach and more of a positive impact in the positions that I've been able to hold as I've advanced in my career to give, you know, to have that influence. So I do want to be the fire chief one day. I would hope to be where I'm at now, because I don't want to move around that much anymore, but you never know.
Now, did you have to move from West Point to Pennsylvania, or is it close? I know New York and Pennsylvania are kind of close, but West Point's kind of on the Hudson. So you had to move your family to where you are in Pennsylvania now?
No. So that's the crazy part. So grew up in Jersey, wife's from Brooklyn. She moved to Jersey when she was young. We met. We ended up moving to Pennsylvania. And I was working here. I made it to captain, and my wife got a job working for the Army and Human Resources, put in for the West Point job just as a developmental thing. Like, I'm going to interview for this job just so that I can build myself off of what they're looking for. So I was very transparent in the interview, and they ended up giving me the job, which I couldn't believe. So I went back to my wife, you know, we just had my son. Literally just had my son, and I said, they offered me the job, you know, what do I do? So she's like, well, don't turn it down. That's a huge, huge opportunity. So I had reached out to the fire chief. I said, listen, you know, we own our home. My wife works for the government. We just had my son. Are you willing to be flexible with the schedule? So it became a point of contingency because I had spent well over 4 years there. So over time, he had, you know, kind of been like on me about like, are you moving here or not? But he was very accommodating, and I'm thankful for that. So I used to work up there for 3 days straight, 4 days straight, sometimes even 5 days straight, and then go home for 2 or 3 days and then go back up there. So that's why I said, because of my unique schedule, I was able to gain a lot of that on-the-job developmental training that most training officers aren't able to have, especially at such a young age that I was at, because they took advantage of it, which is fine. You know, it's like, okay, well, you want us to be accommodating to you, you need the schedule, then you're going to be accommodating to us, and you're going to free up leave spots so that more chief officers can have off now because you're here. So I ended up running the department 2-3 days a week on a regular basis. And that was a big department with a huge mission, and it's constantly in the spotlight. So, you know, that was a certain, you know, kind of thrown to the wolves, figure it out.
So now you're working kind of where you live, correct?
Yeah, the base that I work at now is about 35 minutes south of where I live.
And how long were you driving to get to West Point?
3 to 3.5 hours.
Oh, my God. That's crazy.
I know. But, you know, I grew up an hour south of there. So, though it was tough because my wife and kids were here, we made it work. I know it's odd, but we did. You know, I'm very fortunate to have the wife that I have. You know, we made it work, and it was tough. But, you know, I had family that was only an hour away, so – you know, when I would get off, but I had to come back to work the next morning, I would just drive down to Jersey and stay with my folks or stay with my sister or my brother. My wife would come out with the kids and, you know, stay with my folks, and she would see family because she had family out in Staten Island and stuff. So it kind of actually worked out. You know, we made the best of this odd situation.
Now, how many years, Dave, do you have total on the job there in the military?
With the federal government, 13 and 5 months. And then I got 7.5 in the municipal side, but that doesn't carry over. So just in my pension with the federal government, 13.5.
Okay, so you're at the sweet spot in your career. And, you know, Justin McCarthy, who has taught at FDIC, hopefully he'll be out there this time as well. Made the jump to assistant chief, and he's right at that 13-year mark. So that's a great place in your career to get there. What else are you going to be teaching people at FDIC if they come to your class?
Well, I mean, what do you mean? What other programs do I have, or just in general, what's the class going to cover?
Yeah, what's the class going to cover? Give me a couple other takeaways from the class.
It's actually funny. I was just finishing up my program today, so it's actually kind of fresh on my mind. So mostly I talk about the training officer.
I usually do my program on the plane there. So they always laugh because on the plane there,
I honestly believe that. That doesn't surprise me.
I literally, on the plane there, will start throwing stuff in, you know, moving stuff around. So if you're not 100% there yet, I can respect that.
But it's funny, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself, you know. It's always surreal to me. I'm always very honored to be there. But I remember the first year I got picked, I had my program completely together and ready as soon as I got the email back that I was teaching, you know, and that I had been accepted. And I practiced it every single week until FDIC. And I felt like the first time I did it didn't go so great, you know. And now this one, I just finished everything up today. I'm like, man, like, you know, how things have changed, you know, just over the past few years, you know. No,
I thought it was great. I took your first class, and I thought it was great. So I don't know what you're talking about.
No, I appreciate it. No, but the class, you know, so I'm covering a lot of things. It talks about leadership because at the end of the day, even though the class is a training officer developmental class, if you're a training officer, you are a leader. You know, people are following your direction. So we talk about leadership. We talk about how that, you know, is incorporated into being a training officer. We talk about the importance of coaching and mentoring and understanding the difference between the two. We talk about the challenges that you face in you know, as a training officer between budgets and then you get egos. You got to deal with that type of stuff inside of your department, the internal stuff. You know, you get the know-it-alls that kind of become a distraction while you're trying to put together a program or teach a lesson or whatever it is. You get staffing issues that you run into. We talk about how to be able to get re-engage people, create that buy-in. You know, I use a lot of Paul Combs' illustrations because, you know, Paul is very blessed in his talent that he can draw one of those things and we can all just relate to what he put. You know, like you can have – you can put up one of Paul's drawings on a slide, and you can talk about it for 20 minutes, you know, because it's relatable. We all know it. We've all you know, seen that guy or whatever, you know. So, you know, I have a slide up where Paul did one this past year of the two slugs sitting on the recliners, and, you know, the guy says, you know, are you seriously trying to make us train? And then the other guy says, Chicago Fire's on. You know, so it's we talk about that. And then I end it with the way I end my podcast, which is leaving a legacy. Because as a training officer, it should be important to you what kind of legacy you're going to leave behind. Like Sam was saying before, he was naming some people. And that's important because you're in the business of developing people. So, you know, you have to have some kind of legacy that you want to leave behind so that when you leave, you know, a piece of you was put into there. We spend average of 20 to 25 years in this career that, you know, you want to be able to have left a piece of you there so that it wasn't just a job. You know what I mean? You don't want to just punch a clock. So we talk about that too, about legacies and the importance of having them.
Without a doubt. And I think it's important about the buy-in. I'll go back to when I was a new lieutenant. I got put to one of the most senior shifts in the city, in the Fairhaven section of the city, which is, you know, busy first due company. And I had a very senior shift. And they, you know, they thought I was going to come over there and be a nightmare. And I knew I needed them to get to buy into training. So, and I had a captain that was a great firefighter but wasn't big into training. So what I did was communicate my vision through training and started just doing about an hour and a half to 2 hours every day on training. And what I would do is instead of doing repetition over and over again, you know, all of our skills are perishable. So we don't rise to – you know, expectations, we generally fall to the level of training we have. So instead of running, you know, three evolutions, four evolutions, my drill for the day is I would run through one evolution and I would do it with the company. So hands-on, the first one doing it, whether it was stretching a line, forceful entry drill, whatever it was, I would do it with the company. We would do it one time. And then afterwards, we would critique it and talk about it. And in the critique, I would go first of what I would do differently. And it would get people to open up. And then what the members saw, even the experienced guys who wanted to kind of sit on the couch, they would realize that it wasn't punitive. It was just to kind of hone our skills. And I was vice president of the union at the time when I was a lieutenant. And about 6 months after being in the firehouse, sometimes I'd be on the phone with union business and I wouldn't get to the drill. And one of the guys who had like 28 years on the job came to the office and he knocked on the door. I'm like, yeah, can I help you? He's like, hey, are we going to do our morning drill? And I'm like, no. But here, because it became something that they got used to, even the older guys were like, you know, this isn't so bad. He does it with us. You can fail without being a failure. And we critique it, and we're only doing it once because we were running calls, we were running fires. It was a busy, busy company, and I kind of won over that company.
and I try to tell training officers out there, you want buy-in, you got to participate yourself, and you got to make it fun. And when I went to the training division, how they used to do live burns is they would bring down a bunch of companies, and they would keep them there all day long and do multiple fires in the burn building. And I'm like, this is a 365-member department. What I'm going to do is I'm going to bring down five companies. I'm going to light one fire in the burn building, have them attack the fire, have them overcome some obstacles and objectives that I put in place there, and then critique it, and then have them go back and in the afternoon take down another five companies. And what I found is firefighters would still complain when they got called to the academy, but when they got there and they knew they were only going to do one evolution and critique it, when they got there, the level of cooperation I got was unbelievable. And I'd be like, hey, as a drill master, I'm going to do two training periods a day, a morning and an afternoon. I'm going to call five companies in the morning, do one evolution, critique it, five companies in the afternoon, one evolution and critique it. And it brought up the skill level of the department. I actually saw an impact on fires, and it got even the older members to really buy in the training, that training was about enhancing your skills, not about being punitive. Can you weigh in on that?
Yeah. Well, a lot of things that you covered, that's probably why, you and I hit it off so well the first time we met, is because I'm very like-minded in that. Training has to be fun. One of the things I talk about in the class is I have a thing I say, training is for progression. Training is for development, not for punishment. And the reason why I say that is because oftentimes we have these old training officers, they would bastardize the program. They would use it as a tool to beat up on a guy or pick on a guy or ostracize a guy or bully a guy or whatever. That guys, not making excuses for everybody across the board, but a lot of those guys, that was the culture that they were part of. So training was not fun. So when you use that word training, it was actually like, it was stigmatic. It was taboo. It was like, oh, this guy wants us to go out and do this. Seriously. Like, it was like, you were setting them up to pick on them. And in my experience going to West Point, I was a young training officer, wearing chief's rank, running a training division for a larger department at a very big deal institution or installation, whatever you want to call it. And, I wasn't being taken serious at first. And I remember we had put together a live fire evolution where we were rotating companies just like you did. I had three in the morning, and then in the afternoon I had three more come out. One of the older guys had made the comment, and he said, hey, this wasn't so bad. For the past 15 years, it's like, I dreaded coming out here. When you'd see that on the schedule, it was like, could I take leave? Should I call out sick? And he's like, this was really good. I had fun. And that was like the hugest compliment for me, because I had been there only like 6 months, and it was the first live fire drill that had been set up in a couple of years. And, the guy that was running the, not the training officer prior to me, but the guy that was the chief of the department, he used that as a tool to pick on people and to really run people through the ringer, to almost be like a drill sergeant. Like, look at this guy. He can't hack it. He shouldn't be doing this. That happens, but it's not up to us to sit there and pull the weed. We can't discard them. We need to then develop them, and if you put enough effort into them that it's just not their business to be in, then that's a hard conversation you end up having to have. But in most cases, if you do it where it becomes fun, the guys have a good time. They learned something. They dusted off something that they forgot. You're replenishing something. You eliminated it becoming perishable. And everybody's happy, and I don't understand why it's such a chore for people to understand that. And that's not just the training officer. That's, the guys too, like, you get so many people that are part of that just negative culture of failed leadership that I approach like coming into West Point, I had written something for Fire Engineering about it, and then I used it again coming into here. Letterkenny was, you know, it's almost like you're adopting a beaten dog when you take over these type of programs or that new role. You know, that when you go to pet the dog, they're so used to being smacked that at first they're gonna be timid because they think, well, his hand's over me, he's gonna smack me. You know, so you have to gain that trust with those individuals so that they understand that you're really just there to pet them, not to smack them. You know, and it takes time, but yeah, you know, like what you had just touched on is that happened to me back in 2016, and I'll tell you, it was probably like of all the things that I've been able to see that I've been grateful for. In that moment, I was really down and out. I really thought like this was a mistake. I'm in over my head. I'm not fitting in. My wife is very upset because she feels like a single mother, you know, and I'm just not getting the stride where I need to be. And to have one of the senior guys make that comment in front of everybody was like a huge compliment. Like I just felt I can do this, you know, so it is important to make it fun.
Yeah, I think making it fun is key. And again, it's you don't have to be everything. You have to be competent if you're a training officer, but you don't have to be everything to every person. You just sometimes, you know, teach a class that where your strengths are and cover your blind spots where your strengths are and build and mentor other people. And I think you said it earlier is that one of your responsibilities as a training boss is to facilitate quality training, you know. Look at the line. Is somebody really squared away, whether it's techno rescue, hazmat, pump operation, whatever it is, and mentor them and bring them up and facilitate them to deliver the class or bring somebody from the outside in. And, you know, you said it right off the bat, is you need training to be fun. And you got to change it up. And one of the things that motivated my members more than probably anything else is, if you can do live burns in acquired structures, and if you can't, at least do training in acquired structures where you set up the rooms to, you know, look like how a room will be when they actually go to a fire for search and do some training in acquired structures, you know, that really makes all the difference in the world. And if you're having problems getting acquired structures, talk to your fire marshal's office because they know when buildings are coming down. You want to speak to that, Dave?
Yeah, those resources are out there. You know, that was in one of my other classes. I touch on it briefly about, you know, the importance of networking in this class. And, you know, that goes with the networking thing. You know, here where I work, it's very difficult. There's a lot of red tape to do the acquired structures to burn in. But one of the things that I've been doing that I did up at West Point, and, you know, and we do here is any of the vacant housing units or any vacant building, you know, anything that I can get in, we will run a drill, you know, even if it's last minute, which is not ideal. And I stressed on that for your listeners and I'll stress on it in the class, you know, organization and planning are key. But we're also in the business of, you know, the you know, shit hits the fan while you're in the middle of eating dinner. So, you know, we should be able to adapt and overcome at any, you know, at the drop of a hat, you know. So with that said, you know, there's been last minute phone calls where somebody's like, hey, you know, this building's available today. You know, we're going to be doing demo work to it starting tomorrow. So, you know, I didn't know if you guys were interested. And I will literally go there with dummies and you know, even if I got to grab some desk chairs just so I have some furniture. I mean, anything I can do, you know, the smoke machine and you know, some LED flickering lights, you know, just to really capitalize on this opportunity, you know, and again, you know, that's another thing with reaching into that Rolodex of resources you have. You know, if you don't have those opportunities, if you don't know how to get those things, look, ask. There is somebody that is in charge of housing. There is somebody that's in charge of, you know, if you're in a city, you know, There's a housing authority of the people that are going to be demoing houses or going to be knocking down houses or whatever, you know, they get these, unfortunately, and I know where, you know, you and I are very like-minded in our political views, you know, so I fear that we're going to see people going to be foreclosing on their homes, you know, about another 5 to 8 years from now due to current things that are going on, but we won't go down that rabbit hole. But even that, you know, when you see these foreclosed homes, you know, if that's in your first due, get with these people and see if you can run a drill in there and find out if what their intentions are, if they're going to knock the home down, if they're going to remodel, if they're going to – whatever they're going to do, you know, capitalize on anything you can. Be innovative. Don't half-ass it. Sometimes training gets half-assed, and it's unfortunate. Sometimes it has to happen, and I hate to say that. You know, sometimes we just kind of have to make it through it, and I hate that. But it does happen, so I'm not going to be ignorant and say it doesn't happen. But any opportunity you have to create or replicate or, you know, simulate a realistic training evolution, you know, put as much as you can into that. Not to set people up for failure, but because your guys will then appreciate that. You know, none of them want you to just, you know, to walk through a structure, find the dummy, unplug the smoke machine and be like, okay, case closed, we're done. You know, they want to be challenged if they're going to have to go through it. If you got them off the recliner and they got to put on all their gear, they want it to be worth it. So make it worth it. And it's also, you know, you're cutting your own nose off because here you go and spend, you know, that hour, 2 hours, whatever, of lead time setting up the drill for it to be done 5 minutes, you know, shame on you. What'd you invest that 2 hours for, you know? So make it realistic.
Yeah, and think outside the box. One of the drills I did right before I left, right before I retired from the job was we put on in service the first rescue company with no hose. You know, they operate as a truck at a fire. So we wanted to hone their search skills. So I couldn't burn the houses, but from the housing authority, I got a whole bunch of apartments, and I was able to go to Goodwill, get furniture, have them drop off furniture for me. So I actually furnished the houses, and where I couldn't get bed frames, I got pallets and got mattresses and put the mattresses on top of the pallets. And then I was going to a dinner as the union president, and I'm driving through one of the neighboring towns and I saw a crib. So here I am in a suit, taking the crib out of this pile of trash and putting it in the Jeep. And somebody drove by and they're like, what is going on here? But so I brought the crib because firefighters aren't used to searching cribs. You know, are they going to miss the baby in the crib? And I got three mannequins and a basketball, and I hid those in the house, in the apartment. It was, you know, two floors and small apartment, but it was able to put, you know, victims in the closet door and behind doors and in the crib. And again, I use the same methodology that I use as a drill master. Bring down three companies, have them do an evolution, and then let them go back, critique it, and then, you know, you really get that buy-in. And I use one of those big flashlights as where the fire was. So when they saw the big flashlight, they had to close the door to the fire room, let the engine company know where it was, and then search back. So you got to think a little out of the box. We're at the witching hour, and it's been great to talk to Dave. I'm really looking forward to seeing your class at FDIC. If you could tell our listeners the day, date, and room that your class is in and what your class is again, I would appreciate it. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Frank. So this is Dave McGlynn. I will be teaching on Wednesday, August 4th at 1:30 in room 234. And the name of the class is So You Want to Be a Training Officer, Do You Have What It Takes? I look forward to seeing anybody there.
All right. I will be stopping by there. And for anybody listening, I will be teaching Monday at 8 a.m. in a workshop, how to build your influence and command presence, tactical leadership. So if anybody's out there, hope to see you on Monday. Dave, I will see you on Wednesday. And that's it for Politics and Tactics tonight. Thank you so much. Dave, great show. And one of these days I'll get a sword.
Yes, you will. I appreciate it. Thanks, brother.
All right. Take care.
You too.